Time to cancel the cabal with Stephen Roberts on MSI Radio.
This is Media Streaming International Radio.
All right, welcome everybody. We are live. I'm Steve Roberts, and this is a special Friday night show. I'll cancel the cabal. I have with me my co-host, Jillian Trebilcock. Say hello, Jillian.
Hi, everybody. Hello. Hi, Steven.
And we have on a special guest, Alvin Macklin, out of Manitoba, Canada, and his client and friend, Tanis. Hello, Tanis. How are you?
Hello. Thank you. Thanks
hello,
for having
Alvin.
Us.
Very good.
Hello.
Welcome
how
to
are
the show,
you?
Both of you.
Good. Thank you.
Thanks very much for coming.
Oh, you're welcome.
Tell us a little bit about the story you're going to reveal to us, then, Alvin. I guess start out with your background a little bit.
You want. Sure, I will. Well, for many, many years, as a young man, I was quite interested in politics, and I was an alderman in the city of Winnipeg, in an area of the city of Winnipeg for 8 years, and I ran in an election in 1969 and was elected to the provincial legislative assembly, and I was appointed Attorney General. I really enjoyed that portfolio because it gave me an opportunity to bring in a lot of much-needed, I felt, legislation, including the first Human Rights Act in Manitoba, and I established the first Human Rights Commission. I really did enjoy and felt satisfaction in being a role in government doing positive things. But in 1988, after being in and out of government a couple of times, I retired. I had practiced law for over 11 years before I was appointed Attorney General, and had had a smattering of experience in pretty well all fields of the law, including domestic relations, you know, family matters. Mm-hmm. Well, the political fire in my belly was not completely out. In 2011, I obtained a nomination to run in a federal constituency to be elected a member of Parliament of the Government of Canada, as distinct from the province. And I chose to run in a riding that was represented by a cabinet minister in the federal government, a conservative cabinet minister. He had been previously the Minister of Justice in the federal government, conservative government. I disagreed with his policies, and I was happy to run against him. I didn't think I would topple him because it was a very strong conservative area, but I did shake him up a bit. But during the course of that election, the media gave some attention to it because here was a former attorney general running against another former minister of justice. And so there was some color to it. As a result of the publicity, I got a telephone call from Tanis. And she told me a story which astounded me, and I said, well, look, I'm busy in election, but after the election's over, come and see me and fill out the story. So she did. And when she told me the story, I was incredulous. I really thought, well, how could this be? How could a judge be as malicious and as scheming and all the rest of it as it appeared to me from her story?
What was
so
the
I said,
story?
Look, pardon me?
Well, what was the story, basically?
Well, the story was that she had been in a disputed custody trial, disputing with her ex-husband over the custody of their three sons. Yes. And each of them, the husband and Tanis, represented themselves without counsel. However, it was obvious that the husband was being counseled and directed by a lawyer by the name of Jack King, who I may have want to refer to later. You might want to question me on it. But in any event, it appeared early in the trial, this 9-day trial, that the judge was fixated on making a finding that Tanis was contemptuous of the court. She, in failing to force her children to go to visit with her father when they didn't want to go because they say they feared him because he had done things to them which they didn't like and they feared to go. So in any event, she told me the story about the judge having been very, very tough on her. And I said, well, look, bring me the transcript of the trial and I'll read it. And then I'll decide whether or not, I want to get involved and try and help you. Well, she brought me all these volumes of the transcript, and it was very, very troublesome reading through it, but I did. And when I was reading it, I quite frankly was getting justifiably annoyed. I have to admit that at times I was cursing to myself because of the obvious naked hostility of this judge towards Tanis. And I think this judge pretty well did everything she could to orchestrate what she had in mind. And she had in mind, as I say, to establish that Tanis was an alienating parent, which is a concept that has seen certain vogue in North America and many other places. And
can I just interrupt here and just ask this question? What sort of motivation do you think it is that gets the bee in the bonnet of these judges that they would decide to obstruct her, like this Judge King, in so many different ways? Did she have any sort of collusion or relationship with anybody else? Like, what sort of ideas would poison her, the judge's mind? I think I've got the wrong name here. She wouldn't be called Jack King.
Her name is Catherine Everett.
Everett. Yeah. Right,
now,
yeah.
It would be complete conjecture on my part, but I think that she knew that Tanis was a social worker and had a degree and a master's degree in that field, and I don't know. Maybe she was jealous. Maybe she was out to prove herself as being tough. Maybe she was out to establish a leading case in this whole area of parental alienation, which is a developing concept that was used by lawyers to obtain custody for their clients. I don't know what motivated her.
No, because it's extraordinary. I was looking on the internet only today, and there's a hell of a lot of judges or lawyers who are advocating in America, saying we can protect you if you've been accused of sexual abuse, as though it's a very common thing. But we know that, or any sort of abuse, we know that very rarely is abuse actually, statistically, very rarely is abuse claimed unless it's actually happening, and yet people try to pretend that it's happening all the time. But anyway, she didn't have any other political connections, did she, Catherine Everett, with any other judges or anything?
I don't know, but I know from my reading of the transcript that there was it was clear to me that although she's supposed to be neutral between the parties,
yes,
she was an advocate for the husband, clearly exposed in the transcript.
Okay, I believe. Go on. You're a lawyer, you know. Well, go on.
Reading the transcript, I say I became angry about it because of the manifestation of this bias that she was carrying out, and yes. And she planned, she planned the judicial seizure of the children from school, and she coerced Tanis into silence and wow. cooperation in her plan because she held over her head the fact that as the judge, she was hearing this case, she was in a position to sentence Tanis to jail for being in contempt of court.
How ridiculous.
And she had already established in her mind that Tanis was contemptuous of the court, and she was going to be severely punished in some way for that.
Can we stop there? How would they, what sort of idea, what, give me an example of when they said she was in contempt of court.
Well, you see, there had been a court order, and this is common, a court order establishing custody of the children as being a shared custody, 50-50
yes.
custody.
Yes.
And as such, the father was entitled to have the children visit with him on certain particular days. When the children did not want to go to their father, even though Tanis had taken them out on the street and so on and pleaded with them to go, when they cried and they didn't go and they put up such a fuss, because she didn't force them to go, he, of course, reported that to the authorities, and the authorities concluded that she was in contempt of a court order. A court
right.
order that mandated his right to custody of the children, you see.
And at any stage, did the judge order that the children see a psychologist and go through the proper sort of procedures for the children to be able to express their wishes?
Well, that's one of the key things. At one stage, very late in the trial, mm-hmm. the judge said, look, I must get an assessment done of these children, these boys. The husband reacted negatively. He says, well, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, but basically he was saying, you know, why is that necessary? They've been subjected to so many interviews and so on and so forth. And the judge says, well, don't worry. It's a brief assessment. You shouldn't worry about that.
Yes.
Now, the brief assessment was made by a child worker, and the child worker was categoric in her advice that the children should not be, custody of the children should not be changed unless beforehand there had been an intensive, what's the term, Tanis?
Intensive therapeutic intervention.
Intervention. So that
prefacing, let me just finish, prefacing any contact with the father.
With
because
the father.
At that point, if I could
that was in the report that this child worker filed at the request of the judge, of this Catherine Everett. She completely disregarded that assessment. And she arranged for the husband to pick up the children at school and take them home, and they were not to be in the presence of their mother from that time on unless they met the mother under strictly supervised conditions.
So the exact opposite to what the child worker suggested, the judge, Catherine Everett, ordered.
Yes, that's right. I believe it's exactly opposite to what the judge, the child worker had suggested.
Unbelievable. Well,
yeah.
It's believable. This is what the corruption seems to be, just huge.
Yeah.
So then what happened? The poor children who were terrified of going to the father have now been sent to the very place that the mother was trying to protect them from going out of love.
Yeah, they were allowed, Tanis was allowed to phone them, but all the telephone conversations were tightly monitored, and he could hang up at any time. He hang up the conversation at any time he chose.
That dude, I can't believe that the judge could do that. Surely that would be the point at which you'd have to look at it and say, hang on, this is what was ordered. And you take it back to that point and say, why did everything go awry from that point on? The only contact they've had with any psychologist, which the father objected to, which in itself makes a whole lot of alarm bells go off, that the father was objecting to them have an assessment, then the assessment comes out in the children's favour for their wishes to not see their father, and, you know, that the father, that they have intensive therapeutic intervention and that they not see their father, and then the judge has gone and ordered the opposite to what the advice is. Like, surely that's the turning point where everything went wrong. That's the point at which the law you should be able to take it back to and say, hang on, guys, look at this mess we've made.
I agree. That should have been sufficient for a court of appeal that had, if they'd looked at the case, yes, to have said, hey, there's something wrong here. But yes, Tanis did engage a lawyer who appealed the decision, the judgment of this judge. But yes, that lawyer focused on two or three technical legal aspects. He obviously, to my way of thinking, obviously hadn't read the transcript of the trial, and didn't recognize the extreme bias of this judge and what she had. And since the Court of Appeal seems to almost completely defer to our family court, their attitude is, the family court judges hear the facts. They conclude what the facts amount to, and then they make their decision. The only thing that the Court of Appeal will look at is the application of the law. Now,
yeah,
you know,
I see what you're saying. So what you're saying is that the Court of Appeal, the Court of Appeal defers to the ruling, not the reason for, not how the ruling came about. So the Court of Appeal can be deferring to a ruling that was made incorrectly because they figured that the ruling was just. So
that's
right. Ridiculous.
They never seem to question the assessment of the facts that are they're given in the trial. You see, they think, well, the lower court judge makes a decision about the fact, and we're not going to deal with that. We only deal with points of law. Well, that kind of profound judicial arrogance is very troublesome.
Yeah, and the lawyers are being... sorry, go on.
Sure.
I would just like to add a couple more things, as Jillian pointed out, that the child worker recommended this, and it was entirely against what the child worker recommended, the judgment. There were a couple other things that were recommended by professionals during the trial, which was in April 2009, and that was there was a custody assessment done in 2006 with a clinical psychologist, and she had recommended in her report that the mother, that I receive, that I be awarded sole custody, and also at the time of the trial, the Child Protection Agency had been involved and had stopped all contact with the father. And on the day of the judgment, the child welfare worker in Manitoba, it's called CFS, that had interviewed the youngest child, had recommended in consultation with her supervisor that the father begin supervised visits. So instead
unbelievable.
So in complete opposition to what the people that had met with the children. We also had, there was also a children's advocate that is funded by the province. He had met with the children a number of times, one, two, or all three, and came in. I had subpoenaed him to testify with, and he brought in his file, and Judge Catherine Everett would not allow him. She did not want to hear his testimony.
Well,
and
that was on the basis that of her interpretation of the act that the child advocate had to keep everything that he heard in secret, which makes the child advocate's role ridiculous. But the Court of Appeal did not disturb that concern. Now, that was a very good argument that was argued before the Court of Appeal by this lawyer that Tanis had hired. But the Court of Appeal disregarded that.
Why? How can they do that?
Well, they just can do it. One of the points also that, you know, is cries out is that at one stage, after the child, this Child and Family Services Agency had reported to the police, they're obligated to send to the police any allegations of child abuse if they appear to be, you know, somewhat legitimate. They've got to refer them to the police. The police had looked at this and had arrested the father. On one occasion, they'd actually arrested the father. He came down. He had a lawyer, but the lawyer didn't play much role in it. The father talked the police into believing that the children were just making these stories up, and he was free to go.
Oh, my God. How did that happen? It's just that father's such a bastard. I cannot believe that he could talk somebody into that sort of thing.
I had an old friend who would say, when that word was used, with all apology to the legitimate bastards.
Exactly. I like your friend very much. I think I'll use that from now on. Being an Australian, we use it a lot. And I will now apologize to all the very beautiful, legitimate bastards.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
That's extraordinary. So basically...
What we're at now is that...
Where's it come now? Tanis
has been trying unsuccessfully to get a modification of these very draconian orders that prevent her from having any reasonable association with her boys. A very restricted contact that she has with the boys. And she can give you the full detail on that. She has to pay a fee to go to an agency where they monitor everything the children and she say to one another. And they have to be guarded in what they can say to one another. Any telephone calls that she makes are tightly monitored by the husband. Now, she's been asking for a modification of this. The court has refused to modify these stringent conditions that have lasted now for over 4 years. Tanis's is 4.5 years. Now,
children are still being abused all the time. Go on. Sorry.
Yeah, what we did is exhausted the remedies, the applications to the courts that could be made here in Manitoba. We then made application, she did, to the Supreme Court of Canada, which is the final court of law in Canada. They refused declined to hear the appeal. So now we're in the process.
Sorry, can you repeat that? Sorry, I wasn't focusing properly. I need to hear that. Can you repeat that again, please, Al?
Yeah. We had exhausted the remedies that were available to appeal this horrible, tight control of the children by the husband, the strict visitation regimen that he imposed on the mother and the kids, or the court, with the court sanction, of course.
Mm.
So we went to the court of the Supreme Court of Canada, asking them, pleading with them, to look at this case, and provide some relief to this terrible injustice. Yes. The Supreme Court declined to hear the appeal. We are now in the process of launching a complaint under the provisions of the United Nations, and so we can bring this forward, and hopefully get people to understand the nature of this injustice that's occurring. And I suspect, and Tanis believes, she's done a lot of reading about this, that this kind of thing is going on with numerous families where children are being isolated from one parent at the discretion of courts that are not being fair to those kids or the mother.
It's absolutely right. That's why we're doing this show. We're absolutely astonished at the number of children who are put into the hands of the abusers. And why, once, it's like for example, with Catherine Everett, once they make a mistake, they seem to be more attached to their reputation and talk to their cronies to keep covering up all the time. They're just like covering their trails rather than saying, look, I've made a mistake here.
I think you're right. I think that's a fair assessment. And furthermore, what appears to happen is that even if another judge may think that the judge was too severe, they're not going to openly criticize them or try to do anything about it, because it's, you know, they kind of circle the wagons and protect the system.
Yeah, that's right. And it happens in all clubs and groups and everything, but nobody's game enough to stand up and speak out, or some few people are, like Barry Goldstein, and he did, and he took on a judge for being wrong, and what did they do to him? They debarred him. There's just so much control that it's got nothing to do with the word justice or truth or fairness. Yes, Stephen.
Sure.
Yes, I think it's noteworthy that there were three. I did submit three appeals, one with a lawyer. That cost over $20,000. And then the other two were with the help of Mr. Macklin. And the last appeal, they denied, categorically denied, no remedy whatsoever, was just this last April, in April 2013, and my oldest son was already 16. And one of the things they said, wrote in that denial of that appeal, was even though this order is that had been in place now for almost 4 years, was harsh, punitive, and not in the children's best interest, they couldn't do anything about it, or they weren't willing to do anything about it. They certainly could have done something about it. And I was simply pleading for my children to have their mother back, at least half time, for us to be released from these sanctions imposed on us.
It seems to me you're doing more than that, Rachel. It seems to me as though you were trying to look after your children the way that they'd been asking you to look after them when originally... originally when they, they were begging you not to go to the father. They told you the reasons why, and yet you couldn't protect them because the legal system acted against you.
Yes, but and also after 4 years, it's been more of an issue. When is enough enough? Like if I was seen to be in contempt of court, or if I was accused of parental alienation, as I was, then how does that compare when it was only a little over a year that my children had not seen their father, not been going, and by comparison, we have had no life together for now 4.5 years. So the payback
I want to lead this so that it makes sense, because the children had many psychologists and child protection workers saying they should not see the father and that he should have supervised access.
One of the things that I think you might be interested in respect to this is that the major newspaper here in this city, which is called the Winnipeg Free Press, generally has a reporter down at the law courts building. His name is Mike McIntyre.
Yes.
And after the Court of Appeal had made its decision rejecting Tanis's plea for some relief from this very restrictive visitation formula, and they wouldn't do anything about it. The Free Press, this reporter, wrote a story which was defamatory. Clearly, I believe, libelous and defamatory. He deliberately left out words that were negatived what otherwise would be a positive statement. She was saying to the Court of Appeal, even if, you know, there's some suggestion that I've been prejudiced or so, I forget how she worded it. Even if I did that, I've been subjected to more than sufficient punishment all this time. And so what the reporter indicated is that he left out these words, these exculpatory words, and he said that the mother had lied all this time in court. Well,
that's extraordinary. That's extraordinary because you've gone from being a heroic mother into being
horrible.
A victim. And then she's saying even if, but it's not even an even if, because it should have been and never was.
Yeah, that's right. But in any event, I went to the newspaper and I told them that, you know, that this was, I showed them the judge's wording and what the court reporter had done with it. He'd altered the wording, and they didn't do anything. Now,
so can the court reporters be influenced by, told what they're allowed to write so that they can maintain their status as a court reporter?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know.
I mean, what
in any event, Tanis did try to find a lawyer that would take a case, and then he explained that it was going to be harmful to the kids and all the rest of it, so we didn't pursue that.
Mm,
didn't
pursue
a claim against the newspaper.
Mm. So bring it up to now, Al. Where are we now?
Well, where we're at right now is that I have been working with Tanis's help on the drafting of a complaint to the Human Rights Complaints Committee. And they apparently have a committee of the United Nations that will respond to complaints of people who have been injured and no relief has been provided by their state. And that's certainly the case here. Now, whether or not the United Nations will respond to this, we have no idea, but I personally hope that at least this may broaden the knowledge of people everywhere about this situation that's going on.
Gosh, I wish you could get an article in the local paper about the truth of this situation or Tanis's, Tanis's situation.
Well, I did visit with the editor and pleaded with him, but to no avail.
I wonder why.
I don't know.
So
why, when Tanis said that she had been in touch with you folks, and that there are people in other parts of the world that are getting concerned about these practices that are going on, that I'm happy to get involved and talk to you.
Stephen, do you need to say anything? I've got something to say, but just Stephen, just jump on me. Okay, so what I'm getting is that Tanis wants people to come on board, other people to come on board in this United Nations complaint?
Yes, I think that would be most helpful.
Yeah, that would be, because it's happening everywhere and it's not a fantasy, you know, it's not...
No.
It's not sensationalism, it's just a fact. But we've just come across so many people with this. This is why Stephen and I've sort of dedicated ourselves to doing this. And everyone we interview is a lawyer. I mean, we've just got lawyers, judges, lawyers, lawyers, judges that keep telling us the situation is actually happening. And yet not enough people really want to talk about it. And it's really hard to get it out in the public. Al, do you want to say anything about this judicial review and the associate chief judge?
Well, that is an interesting kind of sideshow. I've written letters to the editor, and one of them I condemn our law society. You see, in Manitoba, lawyers are governed under an act of the provincial legislature that authorizes the establishment of a law society, and they lay down the terms and the conditions of under which lawyers can operate. They have to, you know, pay an annual assessment fee, and they have to ensure that their books are held in proper order and so on. And all of that is, I don't question with any of that, but they control the standards within the legal profession. Now, this fellow Jack King, whom I've already outlined, was, well, maybe I haven't in this sequence. This Jack King was exposed fairly recently as a lawyer married to someone who was a judge now and associate chief justice of the family court in the province of Manitoba. This Jack King had sent to one of his clients, he was acting in a divorce action, sent to his client over the internet pictures of his wife in the nude, shackled or in bondage.
Oh my God!
The man who was the recipient of this these terrible pictures had agreed to keep it quiet. He'd signed a hush hush agreement, but after some years, he decided that it was wrong, and here was a judge of the court that had been involved in this, and he claims that this woman, this judge, at that time she wasn't a judge, she was a practicing lawyer, I believe.
This is the one who was doing the bondage sex acts.
That was her husband had taken these pictures and put them on the internet, and this chap claims that this Jack King, this lawyer's husband, who mm-hmm. became a judge, this yeah. Jack King had arranged for his wife to have meetings with this guy, and
which guy?
I guess arrangements for some further sexual activity.
Oh,
and
my God.
That's what this complainant said. Now he was sued because he had broken this agreement for to keep this settlement in secret, and there was a hearing. The court fined him. He had to pay the money back that he'd been paid, and he paid a hefty fine. But this aroused the interest of a lot of people. What was going on with this lawyer? Why did she allow her husband to put these pictures on the internet? Well, she became a judge. Now, the concern was, was she aware of the fact that he had put these on the internet when she was appointed the judge? Could it any way have affected a decision of those who were screening her to be a judge if they'd known about this? Did she tell these screening people about it? All of this is up for question. So the judicial inquiry was established. That's under the provisions of Judicial Act, and it was a three-judge commission of inquiry, judicial council, and they started holding hearings. Well, the judicial council was fraught with difficulties right from the beginning, because lawyers were trying to prevent the commission from hearing all of the evidence, letting a lawyer for the commission cross-examine this fellow, the husband of the judge, and so on. Anyway, it's one hell of a mess, and the people who want to stifle this had brought an action in the federal court, which is different from the Supreme Court, federal court, to shut down this judicial inquiry. And it's frustrated the operation of the judicial inquiry. Now the judicial inquiry, the commissioners, three respected judges in Canada, have resigned. And so it's back to square one again. Yeah. It's a farce.
Look, I actually have a distant relative that I met at a family party a few years ago who told me she was a secretary in a brothel, but I'm quite sure she's probably a bit more than that, and a receptionist. I'm quite sure she was receiving some interesting things, because she said you wouldn't believe the number of lawyers that turn up with ladies' underwear on.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and the ones that want to be...
I don't like, conjecture on a lot of that stuff, but that certainly is open to people to wonder what is going on here. But certainly the lawyers in Manitoba, many, many of them, and apparently many people in the judiciary, knew about this terrible conduct of this judge's husband, and yet they kept their mouths shut.
Yeah, and I heard that over $10 million has been spent on this case. There were
an enormous amount of money, yeah.
Yeah, over $10 million of the public money has been spent, and now they've collapsed the case, and all the judges have resigned.
And the Law Society that should be monitoring the moral and ethical conduct of the lawyers that they're supervising knew about this and didn't do anything until this chap came forward and exposed this thing. And then the Law Society called him in for a disciplinary hearing and fined him, I forget what it was, I think about $13,000, which would cover the costs of all the lawyers that were involved in investigating and establishing the case against him.
Yeah, right.
And let him go right back into practice.
Unbelievable. It's just absolutely frightening. And yet the mothers can't even get legal help, and that would only pay for their bloody lunches anyway, wouldn't it? Like, it's $11,000. I thought it cost $10 million.
Well, from my perspective, there's a good deal that needs to be done to clean up the moral and ethical standards that are being wasted in this province.
Well, absolutely. It just seems like there's an incredible amount of corruption. And even if you're good, you have to be very, ethical and interested in fairness. The judges and the lawyers are really up against it. And it takes somebody like you, who's now retired, to be able to be free to speak.
Well, I have nothing to lose. I have nothing to gain. I just, I'm not content to sit back. When Tanis asked me to help, I'm conscience-stricken that I've got to do what I can. Now, I'm not doing nearly enough for her. Tanis has asked me to stand in front of the law courts building or the legislature with a sign. I haven't done that. Maybe I should have done that, but I wanted to take the high road, you know, do everything the way that is expected of, you know, a lawyer, even a retired lawyer in society. Use all of the legitimate systems to try establish justice, but we sure as hell haven't got it yet.
You sure haven't. Can you open a retrial? I'm sorry, I seem to be yelling. I often get excited and yell. Can you open a retrial, Alk? I mean, and take it back to the point where the psychologist reports and the child workers reports.
It wasn't a psychologist. It was just a child worker.
No, but there was also Tanis jumped in and said she'd actually had a psychological assessment by a psychologist on the child who also recommended.
Oh, well, this judge, when keeping Tanis under the threat of imprisonment for being contempt of court, judge said ordered for the seizure of the kids from school and ordered Tanis to undergo a psychiatric assessment and laid down a regime for visitation. And all the reports had to be filed. And when Tanis did have the psychiatric assessment made, she wanted to establish that she had not done anything wrong and she wasn't in contempt of the court. She did all those things. When she filed the psychiatric report that was prepared, which said, look, there's nothing wrong with this woman, the judge was troubled that the psychiatrist hadn't completely read all of the documents that the judge had wanted her to read, and the judge wanted to read to influence the psychiatrist's decision. Now, that's not ridiculous. An independent assessment.
Right, that's not an independent assessment.
She was trying to influence the psychiatric assessment. And that is wrong. But she got away with all those things. No one questioned.
So this is sort of what my question is. I'm saying, why can't you take it back to the point where the miscarriage of justice first took place, when the original judge, what was the original judge's name? A woman, Catherine somebody or other.
Catherine Everett.
Yeah.
EVERETT.
Right. So why can't Tanis's case be reopened on the basis that there was a miscarriage of justice by Catherine Everett, and why can't it start back there? What legally reasons can't you go back and fight it there and say this is where it first started to go wrong? Why can't the case be reopened at that point? I've got no idea. I'm not a lawyer. I'm just a radio personality.
Well, that's a good question. I haven't asked myself that. Maybe that's open to her. I don't know. That's the point that
I'll interject here. I did try that. The motion to vary after the first appeal was denied is the way you try to go back to the beginning and say, let's motion to vary this now. It's been over 2 years. The children haven't had their mother. And Catherine Everett denied that motion to vary. I was very concerned about her hearing it because Mr. Al MacLean confirmed, you know, the bias that I felt had occurred throughout the entire trial.
Why can't it be reopened, Tanis? Why can't you?
Well,
what's the problem there?
Well, you file a motion
at that point.
You file a motion to vary the judgment after the appeal was denied. I'm trying to explain that. And she denied that motion to vary. and she has seized herself, the same judge, meaning she stays on the case, and she refused to recuse herself, even though Mr. Max...
Okay, go on.
She refused to take herself off the case, even though there was a very reasonable apprehension of bias, because Mr. Macklin, by that point, had read the entire trial record and tried to testify to what he read as a reasonable, well-informed individual. And
can you take the judge off the case? Can you take the judge off the case?
No. That's
why
what
not?
We tried to do.
But
she refused.
Can't you do it?
She gets to decide, the judge themselves gets to decide whether they've been biased or not. So that in itself is a conflict of interest.
Well, now there must be a law against that.
You would think.
Well, you would think so. You ask a question as to whether or not it's possible to institute a new piece of litigation, a new claim. I don't know the answer to that, quite frankly. It may be possible, and I'll have to talk to some of my legal friends, if I can get them to talk to me, about that.
Yes.
Well, I think the other way they have closed all avenues for me, Al, and I think you would agree.
Vexatious litigation.
This is another strategy they're using. So first they stripped my sons and I of all our natural, inherent, inalienable rights. Mm-hmm. And then in me fighting to have my rights reinstated to be my children's mother, for them to have their mother, they declared me a vexatious litigant.
You know what really annoys me here? Because it almost sounds to me as though... I would not be saying that... I mean, I really agree with their rights to have their mother, but if their father was an okay father, it would be different. But the point is, the reason you broke up with your husband was because he was not an okay father. Isn't that correct?
Well, there was domestic abuse, and that was emotional, verbal, mental, which included him raging at me on a regular basis over really nothing.
The children as well? Didn't he abuse the children whilst you were with him? Isn't that part of the reason you broke up?
Well, the relationship ended in 2003, and the children were only 8 months and 3 and 6 years of age. That in itself, he demanded 50-50 custody, even though it was completely chaotic and stressful. And the oldest child did not want, well, they didn't want to go, but the oldest child was afraid of him. And but I didn't really see it. I think the fear for the children with respect to him when they were that young was seeing him rage at me in front of them. You know, in an uncontrolled kind of way, they felt afraid. In fact, my oldest boy, at one point when there was an exchange of the children, said, "Is Dad going to kill you?" So, I mean, it was very frightening for the children. But, I did not see physical abuse toward them. But that, I've since, read and understood, even though I had a master's of social work. When you're in a situation, it's hard to have perspective. And
you tried to be fair.
Yes, and I did go along with it. It was really the rage at that point here in Manitoba. We had just had these people come into the city and train all the legal professionals and the collaterals, the court collaterals, the psychologists on parental alienation, and that there's no difference
in it.
I didn't believe in it. No, they all did. Right. And they all supported this. We went for mediation. I didn't take him to court right away. He took me to court after a couple of years demanding the 50-50 custody. We did meet with lawyers, but everybody was recommending to go along with what he wanted. And just be agreeable, be cooperative. And I was working part-time as a therapist, so he did kind of get to set in motion what they call a precedent, but it never worked. That was my whole point. It never worked for the children. I had a fight on my hands every week, every second day, to make them go half time according to his demands. And they were very young. Mm-hmm. And part of this theory with Michael Lamb and Joan B. Kelly, I'm not sure if she's from Australia or California, but they have been marketing this way of thinking that there's no difference between the mother and father. So even the attachment issues that have been long-standing and studied, you know, the attachment of young children to their mother has just been wiped away. And this attitude of even a nursing baby should be able to go back and forth 50-50. And
that's insane. Isn't that insane? Mm-hmm. Isn't that just unbelievable? How can you take a child away from the breast, you know, and send, while your breasts are busy swelling up and the baby's wanting their mother again, to put them within the...
And it's also like, you know about animals, Jillian, but it's pre-verbal children, they need that continuity of space.
Yes.
So it created so much chaos, and I thought the resistance to their going when they were, you know, young was because of that. I still made them go around my part-time work schedule and his demands. And he was starting to call me a parental alienator even in 2005, the father, my ex, and even though there wasn't even a court order. And for the most part, they were almost going half-time, but I was still a stay-at-home mother and their primary caregiver, so it really wasn't. It was just on paper, he could say, it was half-time. In fact, it was two, maybe three evenings, and the bulk of most of the weekends, which he demanded. And, you know, I had no family here in the city, so I went along with it, and, you know, he then set this status quo.
Yeah, you got one.
I want to interject here for a moment and say this. You know, I have come to the conclusion that this ex-husband is not only very clever, he is very careful in his planning. And he documented every instance where there was anything, any probable basis to report Tanis as not responding to the court orders and so on. He was, I would say, almost diabolical in his thoroughness to develop the situation that he wanted to in order to get control of those boys.
Extraordinary.
He's very clever.
Yeah, he sounds like a very, very, very cunning, a very cunning
and very
father.
Persuasive. Very persuasive.
What I would like to say is what is shocking, really, in all of this is that I was accused of parental alienation for that period of time that the children didn't go at all, which was less than 2 years, and they still went, but not half time, and yet. Nobody has questioned, and this is what happens in these cases too, is that the courts and the court collaterals, there was a psychologist that the judge appointed to ensure this custody takeover and make it look good, and none of them will speak to how he is actually the parental alienator. Now that he's been given, my ex has been given complete control. Actually, I have not been allowed to speak to the children for a year. The last time I spoke to the children on the phone that he monitored was the day my son turned 16. That's almost an entire year ago, because that my oldest son will be 17 in within a week. And so over 4.5 years, he has systematically, with this court order, completely eliminated me from every facet of our children's lives. Like, I don't exist.
That's exactly what the lawyer, attorney Barry Golding, Goldstein says, is that men who abuse women like this just continue to, and children, continue to abuse them after the marriage, and this is one way that he's abusing you, and somehow he's managed to manipulate very easily by the look of it, the court system to add to the abuse of you. So you're experiencing incredible abuse, and the children are experiencing abuse because of a miscarriage of justice by an abusive judge.
Yeah, I think you summed it up pretty well. Yeah. Can she take this judge to civil court? It may be possible, and you know, it could well be done. However, what she's facing is the fact that they obtained an order declaring her to be a vexatious litigant. That means that before she can bring any action in court for any reason, for anything, that proposed action, has to be vetted and screened by the court itself. And in effect, it makes it very, very doubtful, maybe hopeless, that you can bring a civil action in a Manitoba court right now while that order is in place.
And I would also add, Al, is judicial discretion, judicial immunity, and judicial independence basically are the three, pillars of the judiciary, and really nobody can hold them to account. And I don't believe that. And plus, there'd be a conflict of interest in suing them. You're not allowed to take this. You're not allowed to report any criminal offenses by a judge towards you. One crime, I believe, that's being committed against my children and I, one criminal offense against my children and I every day since June 2009 is intimidation, which is Section 423 of the Criminal Code, because to be forced against our wills to stay away from each other every day for some 1,600 days and nights, to not talk to each other, to be reported on by the police, for my children to be told that I could go to prison if they were to reach out to me, is complete and constant and chronic intimidation. And yet,
yeah,
I should be able to make a police report.
It's a violation of children's rights. The children's are being abused by the system. The judge doesn't care about the children. Nobody cares about the children. This is the thing that really, really annoys me here.
Yeah, it appears that there's no relief for children until they attain the age of majority, and that's 18.
Yes, that's correct.
By the way, I want to blow my own horn here a little bit. When I was Attorney General, the law was then, the existing law was that no young person could own land or could sign mortgage documents or all these other legal things unless they were 21 years of age. I'd learned that England had changed their laws to move the age of majority to 18. So I introduced the legislation in the legislature, which was passed, and we established the age of majority as 18.
Good on you.
However, the legal age of consent in Canada is 16 for a young person to even be engaged in sexual activity with someone that's...
You can have sex and make babies at 16,
yes,
but you're not allowed to own a home for them until you're 18.
Uh-huh.
Or you're not allowed to know. They're, by this law of keeping children under custody orders, so-called family custody orders, until they're 18 without a say, without a choice, without freedom, without rights, is like saying these children have no idea what they feel, what they think, where they feel secure, where they feel loved, where they feel at home. It's as if They have no idea of what they feel about their own family because they're also kept away from their maternal grandparents by this order.
Yeah. And, well, it's against the Convention of Human Rights, and that's the point we have to stick with.
Yeah, that's what we're arguing.
Good on you. Because
anyway, is there anything else? Because I am wearing down a bit.
Yes.
I think we've nearly got enough. I just want to say, what's the next thing you're facing? Is there anything that you're facing at the moment, Tanis, that you'd like to discuss? Like, it just seems to me, once again, you know, just for another summation, the children who should have been left with their mother because that was actually their wish have not been asked what their wish is. Their wish could have changed over the last 4.5 years, like their external wish, because they're so intimidated by the father. You have virtually no contact with them whatsoever. I know that you do. They allow the mother, who they really wanted to be with now, to have a very small amount of supervised access. I know that you've been taking lunch to them on those little meetings and tried to make it as familial as you possibly can. It's absolutely disgusting what's happening. I don't know why lawyers, why child protection aren't involved in this. And I really applaud you, Alvin, for all that you're trying to do. And where's it at right now? Like, is there anything that people need to know? Or is there anything we can do either taking it back to where the justice first broke down, or anything that you're facing in the future? Is there anyone out there, like, if there is anyone listening, like a reporter who'd like to run a proper news, a true article in the newspaper? Where are we up to right now, just to wind up, to make sure you're covered for now, Tanis?
Well, when we get this produced, I would like to put something out there that anybody that would like to join the United Nations complaint, and we could be like a representative. What Mr. Macklin has pretty well prepared it by himself, and he would like to make it a class action. So that could be anywhere from around the world that this is happening. Aside from that, people have just recommended I wait until my oldest boy is 18 and then he's free. And I think that's wrong because my other two children, I mean, my youngest son is only 11. He was taken when he had just turned 7, and he's missed his entire childhood. I've not been allowed to be at anything at his elementary schools. His friends, you know, probably wonder, and you know, he was teased about his mom not being at anything. He's to let him go into adolescence, all his adolescence, because his brother turned 18, but he has no say or choice. My middle son's 14, just entering high school. It's just completely wrong. But I've tried everything in the legal system, and I think now it's about exposing them, and that my children, and all children, hear that they, I believe my children have the right to decide. I believe we have the right to be together as a family, and I believe this is incredibly wrong.
I think that there has to be enough public understanding of the issues here that they'll bring pressure to bear on governments to make things right.
That's a good point, Al. And actually, there's quite a bit of echo here. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's because I've taken my earphones off and I've got on. I do have a couple more things to say. I'll just plug in properly. You talk, Tanis.
Okay. We have a constitution. It's a bit different than the American one, but it still is a Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and then the Constitution Act, which was in 1982. And there is a section in the Constitution Act, as I understand it, Section 52, where the government actually has the authority, if not the obligation, to void any law or legislation that is in conflict with the Charter of Rights and Freedoms.
Okay,
which
so that's where you can pull yours apart, surely.
Well, I've tried, but maybe with exposure there'll be some pressure, and more and more of these situations, these extreme custody orders that Barry Goldstein has written about, and I've included in my filings, that risk children's emotional health and well-being. As more and more of this is exposed, maybe, I believe these orders can be declared void. And we have been put through a nightmare. They're my son's entire childhood. So, and they're also Canada, where it is a bit different than the United States, and I'm not sure about, well, Australia has, but the United States has not yet, but Canada became a signatory country to the United Nations Convention of the Rights of the Child this month, November, in 1989. So how many years is that? 20, almost 25 years. And look at the children, at like youth of 16 have no rights. Like, people are flabbergasted when they hear cases like this, because they say, oh, well, a child can decide what they want, which parent they want to live with when they're 12, can't they? Or 14, or, well, for sure by 16. Oh, no, apparently now we'll wait till they grow up when they're 18. Well, that's incredibly ridiculous.
Janice, I just cannot believe that you can be talking about this sort of so calmly and intellectually in some ways, because as a mother, and I breastfed my children, both of them, for a very long time, I just would not have gone through that. I would have been absolutely ferocious. I'd probably be in jail, because I just don't know how you manage to handle this, because any woman who's really listening to this, nobody really seems to understand, well, particularly men, the ferocity of emotion that is your instinct to protect your child, and to have it just... for me it is, to have it
absolutely
again, to have it taken from you again and again and again and again and again, is just so unfair to the mother, and so we have that instinct because our child needs us to have that instinct.
That's right. And not only that, Jillian, like, to be separated from my children,
yes,
the incredible grief, and also,
yes,
this prevention order that this woman judge, Catherine,
yes,
Everett, put on me 2 years ago,
yes,
is actually,
yes,
gives license to,
yes,
their father or anybody that sees,
yes,
me in the community to call,
mm,
the police if I so much,
yes,
as see my children in a public,
yes,
place.
It's just
this
unbelievable.
What kind of country is this? You know,
exactly.
And it's true. Though I am
yes,
to deny. I am to,
yes,
deny. Just going on what you're saying, Jillian.
Yes.
I am to deny all of us mothers. This is how my natural instincts, like every,
yes,
impulse that beats,
yes,
in my body, because,
yes,
I nursed my children too. I was an extremely,
yes,
responsive, intuitive,
mm,
parent,
mm,
as I was a therapist,
mm,
right? But,
mm,
as a parent, like, I could tell my little boys, you,
yes,
know, when they needed to eat, when they were getting a little sick, and I was very,
yes,
prevention minded in terms of,
mm,
safety. So now I'm to pretend they don't even exist in order to cope. Like, I'm to pretend. I can't, of course.
I can relate to this, Rachel, because the other day, one of these women who I've met was messaging me how she was actually with her husband's grandchildren and how deeply she loved this grandchild. And I want to point this out, because at first, there's been a part of me that stayed intellectual about it. But when this mother was just talking to me in chat on Facebook, she was talking about how much she loved this child. And seeing her love, knowing she couldn't have her own two children, and seeing her love that she had for this grandchild, you know, she's saying, you know, how women, you know, and I tapped right into the way that we love our children. And I'm sitting here in the other side of the world on chat, so she couldn't hear me. And I just started to sob loudly, you know, like a woman sobs over a child. And I thought, that's really interesting, because I've stayed disconnected in some way. I've known intellectually and emotionally, but in my, you know, in that mother heart, where I could really deeply, deeply connect with how much we love our children and how much our instincts are to do the right things by them. This is a normal, healthy mother, which most of us really are, or the world would all be dead. You know,
yes,
we've managed to rear 7 billion children. We've done bloody well.
Yes.
And then, you know, it's really hard to connect. But if people are listening, to just remember how much we love our children and what we would run over hot coals for our children. This
That's
is a maternal
right.
instinct that the patriarchal sort of justice system, and women become very patriarchal and disassociated. Like that lawyer you were talking about, she'd never even had any children, had she?
The judge had never. No.
Yeah, they don't understand.
I've heard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about her.
It's unbearable. It is actually unbearable, mm-hmm. I've stayed in my head too. That's why I've, you know, worked and written and read and tried to figure out how. I mean, I have walked around crying and just praying.
You would
have
felt like a wolf, wouldn't you?
Yeah, exactly. I have at times in the middle of the night. I've just screamed out, like I can't take this any longer, being disconnected. Yeah. And I've walked around going, and I guess Al will attest to this too, even from the trial record, is like, I walked around going, how is this possible? The first couple of years, and just sort of, how is this possible that they could really steal my children from me, rob us of our life together without any reason? Like, I've never harmed my children.
Exactly.
I've never.
And imagine, you're going.
Like you said, I'd walk over hot coals for them. I'd run into a burning building for them. And my kids, you know, hopefully they still know that. But from what they see is that I've just disappeared, because all I can do is make the best of those supervised visits. And 20 months of that, the last 4.5 years, those visits were canceled, you know, both by my ex and the Winnipeg Access Agency. Yeah. But everybody
Now let's turn it on its head again, just because we have to wind up. And then imagine what it's like for the children. Like, I mean, remember when we were little and we were just howling for our mother?
Yes, and my little boy said, he even, you know, he tried to express his feelings. They won't even allow that at this supervisory agency. It's against the rules. Yeah. But when he was a little younger, like when he was 7 and 8 still, he said he cried for me and he couldn't sleep at night. And imagine, my children got very, very sick for a long period of time.
Yeah. It's called maternal deprivation.
Yes. Yes.
And that's what's happening to them. And it's just absolutely tragic. I want to finish with some points from Al before we go.
Yeah.
I'll talk to you later, Tanis. But is there anything last thing you want to say, Tanis? But people just really need to recognize what is happening to mothers and children with this bogus parental alienation syndrome that was dreamt up and devised by a guy who became, wasn't he a known pedophile, that gardener who he was, from what I
Well, he said some very suspicious things, like there's a little bit of pedophilia in all of us, and he did allegedly commit suicide by slitting his throat. This is not a healthy individual.
Yeah.
I just would
and
like to say...
completely disproven theory. Parental alienation is a disproven theory for anybody who's listening. It's not accepted in Australia. It's not accepted by the psychology board. It's not accepted in... I don't know where else it's not accepted.
That's good to hear.
Yeah,
I think one more point I'd like to make, Jillian, along like the actual head part of this is, Amnesty International has a category of 7 elements of torture. This is pure torture. Mm. That's what it is. Mm. It and actually I went through that list of 7 and I checked each one.
Yes, well, people need to read the International Conventions of the Rights of the Child and actually sit down and examine a number of children's rights that are being violated here. And I think that's a good point to segue over to Al.
Yes.
Mac.
Okay. Yes, Jillian. Yes.
Well, just sum up for us, will you? Thank you, Stephen. All right.
The World Court.
The European Parliament. Would that be Stephen?
It's ridiculous. We have to even go there, isn't it? You know, but yeah.
Now, how do you access it? Do you know how you access the World Court? Yeah, that'd be interesting. Yeah. Well, I'm at the last stages of of preparing this document. It's called a complaint to the Human Rights Complaint Committee. And I'm going to be covering with a letter pleading with them to accept this complaint and review it and take action. I don't know what will come of this, except that by making this complaint, we will be able to refer it to the attorney, the Minister of Justice in Canada, bring it to his attention, file it again with the Minister of Justice or Attorney General in Manitoba, and we've got a list of them we're going to send it to, and hope that we can get some response, some recognition that there is a problem, and it has to be dealt with.
Yeah, good on you.
Yeah.
Oh, look, I've just found the World Court, and there are cases of intergenerational state removal of children. Oh, there's lots of things there. I'll send you the link, Tanis.
Yes. Good.
Okay. We are
court-generated conflict and its impact on children. The World Court are dealing with that at the moment. Court-generated conflict and its impact on children. I'll send the link to Tanis now.
Good. Well, we would send it to them too. Yeah.
Yeah. She'll give it to you.
Jillian, okay. is it the European Parliament?
I've just got the Sixth World Congress of Family Law and Children's Rights, Rights Voices That Need to Be Heard media release on the 6th of March 2003. And in it, it has court generated conflict and its impact on children. That's it.
Okay. And we have the European Parliament. Stephen, when you send out this link, I will try to attach that to it, the European Parliament, and can see if we can bring out more worldwide awareness as you, Stephen, and Jillian are doing. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart that you're covering this issue, because there's so many children that have been voiceless and motherless. Your children,
like, let's bring it, let's keep it personal. Your children are really, really suffering because
they are
of this, and so are you. And I can really relate to that. And I would, like, I feel like crying now. Like, it's absolutely horrible. It's just insane.
Let me express my appreciation to you, Jillian, and Stephen, for taking an interest in this vital issue, because, you know, one gets dispirited and down, depressed, because these things go on and there doesn't seem to be voices speaking out, you know, and it's so good to hear your concerns about this issue.
Oh, Alvin, thank you for being such a hero.
Oh, that's quite all right. I appreciate your interest. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, all of you. And thank you to you, Al.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you. Thank you.